Welcome to the Culture Pod, the show that celebrates the music, the culture, and the people of the world. And today, I say today, but it's a pre-recorded show today, I'm celebrating the life, art, music, and wonder of Teo Irvine Hendrix. She's my guest today. Teo came into my life through a good friend of mine, Richard McCann, when I was editing his book, Just a Man. He described how, following a loss of his sister, Sonia, Teo said to him, gave him a message from Sonia that only he could have known, and it really blew his mind. After that, I never came across Teo until she turned up one day in my Facebook feed when she, I think, responded to or commented on a post from one of my friends. And I thought, oh, let me get in touch. And I've got in touch with her, only to discover that she is a philanthropist, she is an artist, she's a therapist, she works for peace. She's really quite an incredible person. And in case you haven't recognised the name, she also does happen to be the late Jimi Hendrix's daughter. But she's got a fantastic life of her own that I want to talk to her about. Teo, thank you very much for coming on to the show. How are you doing?
I'm really good, Martin. Thanks for having me here.
Have I done justice to you in my description of you, or is there more to it that I haven't realised?
You waffled a little bit, didn't you? I mean, I'm a healer, I'm an artist, and that's it. That's who I am. That's what I do.
Great. Well, I'm glad that I like you, Teo, because I'm not used to my guests telling me that I'm waffling on my radio show. But I'm forgiving you. You see, it's a pre-recorded show, and I'm not cutting it out.
So good. That's cool. That's cool. That's called not jumping on the ego. So that's a good space to be, Martin.
Oh, you know, no, well, normally the show is live, so I learned to drop the ego a long time ago, and I think most of my audience forgive me. So, as you know, and as you as a home know, you know, what we'll do is we will talk to Teo about her childhood. We'll start right at the beginning and find out how she was formed, if you like, and how she's grown through the years. But before we do that, we're going to listen to our first track. We'll be right back in a few minutes.
No.
welcome back to the Culture Pot. You've just been listening to Witch Queen of New Orleans by Redbone and Teo. Before we launch into your childhood, tell me what made you pick that track.
Witch Queen of New Orleans, it's very much, they're a Native American band. We're part Native American, so we all have that within us. It's about going back to the land. Witch Queen is very much about tapping into who you are at the core of your being. And I'm a seer, I'm a psychic, I'm a somebody who taps into the energy out there. So that's what we do as Native Americans. We tap into the essence of the earth. That's what that track is about.
I can definitely vouch for you being a psychic, because apart from the story about Richard McCann, you marked my card well and truly before we came on air. I confessed to Teo that I hadn't actually heard her music, which was, you know, it's an embarrassing thing to confess because I'm interested in the person and the story. And she turned around and said, "What? So you really, come on, let's face it then, you just want to talk about my dad, don't you? You don't want to talk about me at all." And I fell for it hook, line and sinker. So at least I know you've got a cracking sense of humour, Teo. So moving on, let's go back to where all this begun. Tell me about your childhood as early as you want, Teo. What I'm interested in are the key moments, milestones, and thoughts and feelings that might have shaped who you were to become in the end.
I think I was born very premature, so I was sort of 3 months premature coming into the world. So I was always going to be a fighter. There was always going to be something within me. I was born at 1 pound, 8 ounces. So there was always something that needed to be a fighter within me. Growing up, so I was treated with kid gloves much of the time because of that. But growing up, everybody gave me their full attention for everything that I did. By the time I was 6 or 7, I was sitting on the doorsteps and singing to everybody and forcing everybody to listen to me sing before they could go past my house up the street to where they lived. So it was very much because of my birth and my upbringing, and because I was the youngest one of the family by many, many years. There's a big past age difference between us. I was able to get away with so much. I think the youngest child always gets away with a lot. They learn a lot because they have elders around them. Mm-hmm. So you're constantly learning, constantly growing. And I think that was the journey for me. We had various houses in London, Leeds, Liverpool and Manchester. So we were never in one place for very long. And if you could imagine, when you're growing up and as you start going to school, it becomes a bit of a problem. You never have the right accent wherever you arrive. Also, we were these mixed race kids that were just not accepted all over the place. So I grew up in a very strange time, very difficult times, a time where much of what I represented wasn't accepted. So I had to learn to be able to fit in. I had to learn to be a bit of a comedian to fit in. And I grew up, and it helped me grow up to be quite a strong person. But I had a good sense of humour all that time. One of the things that we were saying, Martin, was about, you know, my accent. And we have these, I used to have elocution lessons because I was constantly trying to take on the local dialect of people and the accent. And in the end, I completely lost my voice of what I was trying to do. And so I had to go and relearn how to find my voice again.
Yeah.
And I did that from around the age of 7, 8, 9, over a couple of years. And I then recognized that how we sound and what we say to people is actually so much more important. It becomes a part that defines who we are. And when you're shifting from place to place, you lose that. I got very lost in those early years because we were moving around so much. So as much as I was loved as a child, I was very lost as a child, being the only black person in the school, other than my sister. There's only two of us, so, you know, the only two of us were the only mixed race kids in the school. We didn't quite fit in with the whites, we didn't quite fit in with the blacks. So it was a very difficult childhood.
And it's, you know, there's a few things there that I can relate to. I mean, firstly, you know, I was on the opposite side of the spectrum. I was born and bred in poverty in a terraced house. And it's very easy for us to look at somebody like you without knowing what it was like and to assume that it must have been a life of privilege. And so it's interesting to see that the personal perspective, the experience, is never quite the same as it looks from the outside. And I can also relate to you with what you've said about accents as well, because I don't know if you can do the Liverpool accent.
Liverpool accent's great. I can do that, yeah, no problem.
You've done that better than my son. He's still working on...
I know, yeah.
He's still working on chicken. But, you know...
chicken. I like chicken.
Oh, that's fantastic, Teo. Fantastic.
I know.
She's bringing out my Liverpool now. What I would say is, as a kid growing up, I looked at my older brothers and sisters, because I was the sixth out of seven. I noticed how they really tried to dampen their accents. And one of my brothers, in fact, was really... I knew, because I was living in London at the age of 18, so I knew just how much natural change would happen. And he was sounding like he'd grown up in the home counties. And I made a decision, no, I'm not doing that, because every time he got annoyed or had a drink, this real accent will come out from the background. So I always thought, I think it's better. I think I knew, even though I didn't know the expression back then, I knew it was better to be a first-class Martin than a second-class impression of somebody else. And that, you know, and really what you've been saying ties into what you do. We'll get to it, but helping people to become authentic, to be the spirit that they are. So with that... we're going to go to the next track, which is definitely familiar to me, and I think it will be for most of our audience, All Along the Watchtower, of course, by Jimi Hendrix. Enjoy.
There must be some kind of way out of here, say the joker to the thief. There's too much confusion, I can't get no relief. Businessman there, drink my wine, plow man, dig my earth. None will level on the mine. Nobody of it is worth. What a joke, but you and I, we've been through that, and this is not our fate, so let us not talk falsely now, the hour's getting late, hey! Kept us you.
So, if you've just joined us, this is the Culture Pot on Radio Sangam on 107.9 FM. My name's Martin Morrison, of course, and today we are celebrating the life of Teo Irvine Hendrix. That was her father playing All Along the Watchtower by Jimi Hendrix. And we've been talking about Teo's early life and how she, you know, had several homes she could go to throughout the country, but she was feeling never quite accepted because one of her colour, being one of only two mixed race people in any school that she went to, the fact that she, you know, had to alter her accent everywhere she went or felt as though she had to, and eventually, of course, realised around the age of 7 or 8 that, you know, she wasn't going to do that anymore. She needed to find her own voice. Now, Teo, you said to me that you were singing a lot whenever you lived, but you also learned the drums from a very early age, didn't you?
Yes, I was given my first drum from my father when I was around 3.5, 4. And he gave me that to help me to calm down. It was a way to get me to tap into my inner, authentic inner beat. And so he would tap a beat on the drum and he would get me to listen to my heartbeat from the pulse, from, you know, take your two fingers, put them on the pulse on your neck, and he would listen to the beat, and then you'd have to do the beat on the drum, and then we'd get it was like a game. We'd get to play until we got the pulse really, really slow, and that was a way of instilling a calmness through the child. And funnily enough, I taught that when we went to Singapore and launched the children's book, which we'll come into. That was one of the tricks that we taught the children over there, because it's really important for people of any age to be able to calm themselves down to their own heartbeat when they need to. A lot of people nowadays suffer from anxiety and stress and all these things, Martin, and, mm-hmm. and if you can find the way to calm your heartbeat down, it doesn't have to be meditation. It's a form of meditation, but you don't have to sit in a room and try and meditate for 20 minutes. You can just still your heartbeat in those, you know, literally in those sort of 2 or 3 minutes. If you can do that, it's really helpful. It's really helpful.
Yeah, well, when I heard about your story of being taught that, you were 3 years old, weren't you, when he taught you that?
Yeah, 3.5. I was 3.5, yeah. Yeah. 3.5.
Straight away, it made me think, oh, that's a biofeedback mechanism, you know, that they're now using this. And for me personally, it's funny how you said you don't necessarily have to meditate. You see, I have a strange condition called arrhythmia. So my blood pressure has to be taken manually, not with a machine, because my blood pulse significantly changes when I breathe in compared to when I breathe out. So all I've got to do is really slow down how I breathe out, and my blood pulse will instantly drop around 5 BPM. So I've learned that, because anxiety is one of those things. Well, it's been with me more or less, depending on my habits, whether or not I've exercised, slept enough, or I don't know, you know, not drinking doesn't help. So
basically the condition that your body's under is affecting that.
Yeah, in fact, you know what? I'm going to throw a question at you now, which you weren't expecting. You see, I believe that the world we're living in and the way it runs and the lifestyle that people are expected to live, you know, commuting to and from jobs that they're only doing half the time because they have to pay the bills and keep the house that they can't live in because they're commuting to the job, and that cycle, that really... we shouldn't be talking about mental illness. We should be talking about the mentally normal state of living in a mentally ill society. That unless people start to do their own thing, they're going to be fighting a losing battle against things like anxiety and depression.
I mean, at the end of the day, you've got to connect to something, all right? Because this is, you know, we're human beings and we have to tap into something. If you don't start by tapping into who you are at your core, and if you don't tap into your own inner beat, how can you ever expect to discover an authenticity to who you are? Because if you actually don't know how the rhythm of your physical, emotional, you know, spiritual being is, you're never going to be able to tap into the next person. And even if you do, Martin, you're not going to find the ones that are right for you, because what you're doing is you're running towards something that looks right rather than something that feels right, you know. And the difference that we have nowadays is we're all getting caught up, or most people are getting caught up, in looking the part rather than feeling the part. You know, the inner beat that we talk about with the Tao method and the Tao Healing Center, the inner beat that we're talking about there is your authentic inner beat, okay? And that's what we're looking to find within you. That's what we help you to find about yourself. So, yes, people are running around doing these jobs that they actually, you know, they have to do to survive. But at the end of the day, they don't have to fall into all the other traps, you know, of driving the most expensive car, or having the most expensive pair of shoes, or living in the most expensive house, or having the most it's all rubbish. You know, we need to be organic and authentic in ourselves. And if those shoes make you feel great, have them, you know, because all of that helps you to live peacefully within yourself. But if they're forcing you, if that job allows you to feel good, and I do understand for some people, they can't do what they love. For some of us, we're lucky and blessed to be able to do the jobs that we love, whether that's helping people or, you know, just doing the things that you love on a daily basis. For some people, they can't do that, but they have to at least find 5 minutes a day where you can tap into yourself and go into yourself and be who you authentically are, you know. And that means tapping into the people around you who are just like you, because actually everybody around you, you have pulled them towards you because there is a mirror of you within them. There's something within them that you see, you know, even the people that you don't like, nine times out of ten, Martin, the things that you don't like about them are the things that you don't like within yourself. You know, you're probably doing the same thing. The only difference is you're noticing it in them because they're mirroring you. So, you know, I think it is about we have to become organic in what we are and authentic, but we have to become true. You know, we have to be really, really true. And sometimes that means sitting on the side outside of the circle that everybody else is in and saying, I'm okay with not being exactly the same as you. I'm okay with being this person. I'm okay with not having the best shoes. I'm okay with not eating meat. I'm okay with being different. I'm okay with being vegan. I'm okay with being me. You know, you just have to be happy with who you are. And if that rhythm isn't the same as anybody else's, hey, you know what? That's amazing. That just means you're unique. And we are all unique. That's what we're trying to find, that uniqueness within us. Is what's going to make us that amazing being, not copying somebody else, not singing someone else's song. You know, what my dad was trying to teach me was, if you can follow your own heartbeat, if you are brave enough, because that's what it's called, living brave, we would call it. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're brave enough to live your own heartbeat, even if you're the only person stood there doing that particular thing, go there, because that's what will make you the happiest. You know, it's not about reading about something, it's about doing it. It's not about pretending that you know all the answers. It's about knowing we don't know most of them and finding our way to them.
There's a lot of value there in what you've said. If anybody has only just tuned in and that's all they've heard in the whole interview, I already think that that's life state changing stuff for some people. It's time to listen to another track which you've selected, which is He Lives In You by James Ray's The Lion King. Any particular reason you chose this, Tao?
I love it. It, you know, I took my children to see The Lion King. They understand all about it, and they understand that we are not just everything about us. We are everybody that's gone before us, all our relatives, our mom, our dad, our kin, all of them live in us, all of the heroes that have gone before us. We are part of those people. Every single one of them, they live in us.
Fantastic. Here it is, He Lives In You.
Child answers,
As per usual, I've been having a chat off air, so to speak, with Teo, because some of the stuff that she'd said before that song had resonated with me, and Teo's invited me to share it with you, so I'm going to. As has been discussed, I think, on previous shows, my childhood wasn't great. I suffered emotional and physical abuse from my late father. And in 1991, when I was 21, he ended up having a heart attack after we'd exchanged some bad words, and he died. And obviously there was nothing I could do to bring him back. There was no way I could heal that relationship. But as time went on, I found my father was living inside me. I started to tap into stuff that I shouldn't have known. I had hobbies and interests that he had had, which I could never have known because we didn't have a good enough relationship for him to have told me. And I also encountered his demons, and I started to understand him a lot more after he had died. Fast forward to 2012, when my mother died. I did have a great relationship with my mother. The first thing that came to my mind was not a loss. It was actually a growth. I realised that I'd absorbed my mum and my dad, and I'd been absorbing them for years. And now that my mother had passed away physically, she was now living within me, and I was the embodiment of all my ancestors, and now the top of this physical family tree, bringing the next generation up. That really resonated with you, didn't it, Teo?
Yes, because I think it, you know, that you realise when you lose your parents very early that you suddenly become the elder. I was the elder within our family. I lost my parents very early, and so I was suddenly an elder by the time I was 27. And, you know, you suddenly see life differently. People are coming to you for advice, and you're like, I have no idea, dude. You know, I'm just a child. That's when you realize how young my dad was when he passed. But I was just a child then. Suddenly I was this elder, and I had to come up with these. I had to grow up super, super fast, you know. And that's the thing. I think when people pass away, within each of us, our parents, our mother, our father, our grandparents, in the same way that we collect, you know, the DNA, we have their ailments, we have, if they have asthmatic, we will probably have that, you will probably have, I think, as you said, what is it you have? You had the
type 2 diabetes.
The diabetes. So we have all these different things. I believe we also have, well, I know from what I do with my healing work, that we also carry their memories. You know, so any fears, one of the things that we look at when we're tapping into things that we didn't speak about this, but I'm going to now, Martin. One of the things that we work at the Healing Center, when we're tapping into people, we really work out where their problem has come from. A lot of it comes from the birth, the time of birth, what's happening around you as you come onto the earth plane, what you hear around you, what you absorb is the fear that you will have. So we'll touch on that a little bit later. But I want to say in support of what you're saying, we collect memories, we collect thoughts, we collect memories, we collect feelings, we collect sensations, anything their body knows, or, you know, your mother, your father, your grandmother, anybody that's connected to you through the lineage, through the years, you will have their memories stored within you. And when they're gone, you tap into those because you're looking desperately for your father or your mother, and you will tap into them. And that's when you realize it isn't just about you shared a life with them, because I didn't share a life with my father. I barely saw him. But I can tap into those things because he's within me. He lives in me. This is his house. You know, it's not just me living here. We all live in this space. And each time we go a next generation further, that person is blessed to know a little bit more. You think your son will have all of your energy. My son and my daughter will have all of mine. That's an amazing gift that we leave them. You know, so we don't just leave them with all the crazy things we said to them. You know, this is your last lesson. You've got to do this. You've got to learn it. We don't just raise children in that way. We raise them even when we're not looking. You know, everything about us is about the journey. It is all about being the best that you can be. And whether we like it or not, that's who we are going to be.
That is a perfect lead-in to the next track, which you've selected, which is Something Inside So Strong by Labisifri. And we'll be right back after this to continue with your life, Teo.
years, the taller I become, the farther you take my rights away, the faster I will run. You can deny me, you can decide to turn your face away. No matter, 'cause there's something inside so strong. I know that I can make it, though you're doing me wrong, so wrong. You thought that my pride was gone. Oh no, something inside so strong.
Oh,
So that was Something Inside So Strong by Labi Siffre, and it's definitely something I can relate to, as well as a lot of the people I know who have been on journeys. We can always tap into this inner strength, and that takes me to my next question for you today, Tayo. These days I'm a writer, and I can articulate very abstract and intangible ideas in ways that people can understand. I can take mystical concepts and write them in a way that your typical cynical pro-science person would go, yeah, I can agree with that. But there's a very early memory that I've got from being around 4 or 5 years of age. It was before they got to me and taught me about heaven and hell and brainwashed me with the, you know, the Christian faith. And I remember lying there in bed. I'd be lying there in bed in the same bedroom as my older brother and my older sister, because there was a lot of us in this house. And I used to sit there, and I was very aware that I was living in this body, and that my brother John was living in that body, that we were having completely different experiences. He was my dad's favourite, and I was the one getting the abuse. And it struck me that this was a transient thing. I hadn't been here long. I couldn't remember anything to do with, you know, before 1970, which was when I was born. And so I had no fear of death either. I had no fear from the apparent nothingness that I'd come from. And I also understood that time, as far as I was concerned, was a concept. It didn't exist. That really, I might be doing John next time round. John might be doing me next time round, or I might even be doing my dad. That after this life was over, after this Martin experience was done, I would then be living in another body. And, you know, I was, no one had taught me about reincarnation. No one had taught me anything philosophical. This, and there was no way a child of five would be able to articulate any of that. I just understood it in my heart. And when I got older, I recognised this, as far as I'm concerned, as a true recognition of my spirit. It was the first time that I could look back and say, that wasn't a kid imagining. That was a kid understanding the truth. That's
Knowing.
So that brings me to my question with you, because I know that you're psychic. I've given you something to go on from my own experience. What were your earliest experiences of, if you like, knowing your spirit?
Oh God, I knew my spirit very, very early. I mean, I knew my spirit. I had my life wasn't simple. My biological father, my father, were two different people. I didn't have an easy life. So I had to witness within the family people being beaten. I had to witness terrible things, you know, and I knew immediately that spirit were with me, because spirit would often take me out. It was spirit that would say, come on, let's go and do something, or they would get me to sing, and that's where I started to sing. The reason I would sing so much is because whenever somebody was being beaten in our house, So a little bit like your brother would be the one who was loved, and you felt that you were the one who was being beaten all the time. So a little bit, every house had the same thing in those days, you know, a little bit like in our house. If somebody was being beaten or something was actually going on, I would take myself away and sing.
Who was doing the beating?
So it doesn't matter who was doing it, really doesn't. But I would take my way and sing. Yeah, so I didn't hear what was going on. I couldn't hear someone screaming or what was happening in the house. So there was a lot of stuff going on. In every child who's grown up has had that going on. I think they'd be very blessed if they haven't, you know, back in those days. So for me, it was, yeah. I knew that a lot. I knew from a very early age I was different. I knew from a very early age when I was in school that I was different from other people. I could see my spirit guide. He sat with me at the table in school, and nobody else would sit with me. I could see my guide sat with me. Do you know what I mean? To sort of hold my hand and make sure that I was safe. But the first time I really, really, really saw him very clearly was in 1988. And we were caught up in the King's Cross fire. There was a huge fire at King's Cross Station in London.
Yeah.
And we were caught up in the fire, and my first boyfriend had just committed suicide. I really was trying as much as I can to pass over and to go. And I'd just come out of the hospital the 2 days before of having attempted a suicide attempt. And I'd been out of the hospital about 2 days, and we got caught in the King's Cross fire. And I thought, this is it. I'm blessed. I can go here and not feel guilty. And, you know, there was part of me that wanted to just run into that fire because I thought I had nothing else to live for. This boy that I thought I'd adored had just killed himself. And so I thought I could run into the fire, but I had my guitarist with me, one of my guitarists, and she was 15. And I remember thinking, oh my God, Alison's mum is going to be devastated if something happens to her. We've got to get out of here. And that was the first time I saw my spirit guide. And everybody saw him, which was the strangest thing. He told us to go to, we couldn't get up through the fire, so he told us to go to the tunnel mouth and breathe. I thought he was saying go to the, because he's an Irish guy, go to the tunnel mouth and breathe. And I thought he was saying go to the tunnel mouth and be, but what he was saying was breathe. And none of the trains were able to stop at King's Cross. They were all coming in, but they were going straight out of the station because of the fire. You could hear all the noise. And we went down there, and that was the first time that I saw him. And a train came in, and we actually, a train came in, and we managed to, and the doors opened, and we managed to get, and there was no way that the train should have stopped there. We got on the train, and I said to the girls, where did the guy go? And I saw him, because in the smoke and everything, I could see him come in. I said, can you see him? And you know what was really strange? The strangest thing was, in my head, I was thinking, who the hell wears brown shoes with jeans? Because all I could see walking towards us, we were sat on the end of, at the end of the platform on the by the tunnel mouth, and there was four of us huddled together. And I was looking at this, and all I could see coming down the platform was these, what do they call them? They call them sky blue jeans, faded jeans, mm-hmm. and a pair of brown leather shoes. Nobody wore them in those days. And I remember thinking, who the hell wears that? And I said to Alison, who wears that? You know, and the train came and it stopped. We got on it, and she said, "Where did the man go? Where did the man go?" And everybody was, "Where's the man?" But I knew it was my guide. He didn't get on the train, and then I started to see him after that. So I see him everywhere after. Well, not everywhere, but I would see him whenever there was a problem. I would see him, and that's when I went and studied the psychology and everything else to start to understand. We must be able to help other people.
Fantastic. I'm really enjoying this interview, and I really appreciate everything that you're sharing with me, Teo. We're going to listen to the next track now, which is Pictured Within by John Lord from Deep Purple, of course. If you've just joined us, you're listening to The Culture Pot. This is Martin Morrison interviewing Teo Irwine Hendricks, and we'll be right back.
Thank you. friends, he'll be heroes, he'll be sunshine, he'll be great, he'll be life, he'll love us bleeding, memories so hazy, and dreams are drove me crazy. He'll be down, he'll be paradise, he'll be star bright, he'll be pain, he'll be smiles, eyes like rainbows. My father and my mother, my sisters and my brothers, pictured within, pictured within. Well, there's shadows illumined by moonlight. There are dragons I have slain. He'll be bright eyes, if he's so golden. Sunrise and sunset, running free and laughing at the rain. Thank you.
So, Teo, in the before that last track, I was asking you to, if you like, go back to your earliest memories of recognising your own spirit and your connection to the wider spirit, if you like. And you gave us a fascinating insight there. But I wanna tap in a little bit further and say, when was the first time that you discovered that you were able to give other people answers or insight or information that you shouldn't have known, if you like? And it was obvious.
I knew that from a very early age. My mother, my mother was a seer, so I knew that. So she would teach us. One of the things that she helped me to understand was how to tap into my own heartbeat and how to find, you know, the essence of who I was, and not to just rely on that first thought that I got. I had to sit with it. So that was something taught me over a long period of time, and so I've known forever, probably from the age of about 13, 14, that I could do that. I knew early on with my first connection. I want to sort of touch briefly on my first connection when we were in Manchester, and I was probably about 5, 6. My little friends died over the road. You know, back in the day, we used to have friends and you'd all play out on the street.
Yeah.
And not like nowadays, you could play on the street. And there was this huge fire going on over the road. And one of the children's mothers had gone out and she'd left a fire on the wall. And she'd locked the children in, because apparently what used to do in those days, people would lock the kids in the house to keep the kids safe. Well, yeah. She'd locked the kids in, and the fire had started and the firemen couldn't get in. And I remember waking up to a room that was full of, you know, we were right opposite them, and our room was full of all these red lights bouncing off the walls and the ceiling. It was all, you know, the shining from the fire outside. And I ran to the window and I said, Tara, you know, the house is on fire. And we could hear them screaming, Martin. We could hear them screaming and screaming. It was horrendous. And then all of a sudden, the firemen went in. The firemen came out with our friends wrapped in their coats. Mm-hmm. And they put them down on the floor, and I couldn't understand for the life of me why they weren't unwrapping them, you know, because they'd stopped screaming, so they were obviously okay.
Yeah.
But why didn't they unwrap them on the floor? Why had they put them on the floor? Why were the firemen crying, you know? And that was when that was one of the first times that I saw my guide, because he was literally beside these children who were our friends, you know, just. And I remember seeing him stand up and walk across to us. And then in the next beat, I could see him in the room with us. And I knew then that they'd gone, they'd died. And that's what it was about. But I knew that they hadn't died on their own, that he'd been with them, you know, as they'd crossed over. So I felt better, because I knew then that no matter what happens, you're not on your own when you leave. There is always somebody that leaves with you. So I knew that these children hadn't left terrified on their own. Somebody had come to take them away before the final death that happened.
Okay, a very moving story. Something else I was going to ask you, because I'm trying to, if you like, tap into the timelines of all the different aspects of Teo. So I know that you're an artist, and I've seen your art. I have actually seen it. Hey, when did that start?
November the 18th last year.
All right. Okay. Seriously, you're not pulling my leg.
No. November the 18th last year, they said, would you like to do some paintings? And I said, I can't paint. And they said, well, you just, my one of my agents was like, hey, you'll just try. And I was like, okay. So, and I just tried, like, oh, this is cool. And I was thinking, how do you do stick men?
Wow.
I was really thinking, how do you do stick men? I looked up how to do stick men, and I couldn't do stick men, so I put it all down. And then on November the 18th, it just started to come into play. Somebody had said, could I do a piece of art for a Harry and Meghan, a wedding thing for them. I had this really good idea of something I wanted to do, and they said, do it for them. So I started to paint it, and then that became, well, that painting did become that painting, but it kept jumping off the easel. And so I put another one up, because that's how spirit work. When they want you to move on to the next thing, they just remove it, and they put, you know, they put your attention somewhere else. And so I started the next thing, and then the first thing I did was Heavenly Father, which was the first piece of art that sold in August at the what was actually the third piece of art that sold, but it sold on the first, within the first hour of it going up for sale.
Well, I'm not surprised. You see, the thing is, when I've seen your art and I've looked at your website and I've, you know, seen you speak before, for me, there's such a maturity in what you do that it's, and also the fact that you're clearly an artistic person. I just felt as though you'd probably always been an artist since the year dot. And of course, in a way, you probably always were, because you're so used to expressing who you are from within. It was simply a case of opening a channel, and that's why the art that's come out seems to be so, you know, not young. It seems to come from somewhere deeper and ageless. Does that make sense?
Yeah, maybe, but it's, you know, it's just, I don't look at my art and go, oh my God, it's art. I look at it and I go, why I didn't fill that colour in, or, you know, wonder why I didn't, but, you know, I've just learned something just recently. They've put up some of Dad's artwork in New York as well. I didn't even know he could do art, you know, so apparently they've just put some up in New York, which is interesting, because maybe that's where it comes from. But I think there's probably an artist within me through the years somewhere, over some of the lifetimes. I've probably done painting, because I find it hard to believe that I can do this without having had any experience. I mean, don't get me wrong, I did study art at school. It was one of the only lessons I wasn't kicked out of. Art, music, English were the only three that I wasn't, you know, and math wasn't kicked out of. But I've never really studied art, and I was tempted to study art now I've done some of the art pieces. But what my curator is saying is, if you do that, it might change the way that you do art. You know, so I'm at the moment, because it's so new, Martin, I've got to find my feet and work out what do I need to do next. But it's really good. I'm absolutely loving it. I love the fact that I wake up, I do this instead of meditation now. So I wake up at maybe 4 o'clock in the morning, jump out of bed, do a bit of art for half an hour or an hour. And then I, you know, put that away, go and get showered and start my day. But that's instead of my meditation now. So this is another form of meditation for me, and I love it. So I look at it and think the strokes aren't particularly normal. And I tend to paint without my glasses on in the morning. So I'm painting in a blurred state anyway. And everything looks great when it's blurred. And then you put your glasses on and you go, oh, maybe not. But actually what that's done is it's created such a unique style that I don't think I can change it. Well, I don't think I can change it now, because I can't do any better. I don't know how to paint.
I can relate with a lot of that so well. Let's listen to the next track, which is I Am Light by India Ari.
I am light, I am light. are the things that cause me pain. I am not the pieces of the dream I left behind. I am light. 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 Hey, yeah. I am light. I am light. I am not the color of my eyes. I am not the skin on the outside. I am not my age. I am not my race. My soul.
So, Teo, thank you very much for sharing what must have been, well, I know was a very, very sad story. Well, you've shared a couple of them, really. But you mentioned before about your first boyfriend's suicide. That was the trigger for you to get more of it, you know, to embark on a life of studying psychology. Is that fair to say?
It was a trigger for me to stop music. I just couldn't understand. I was in a recording studio when somebody came onto the set and said, you know, called me off the set and said, you need to go home immediately. So it was definitely a trigger for me to stop music, because music seemed so trivial that if you think about it, I'm in a studio playing some stupid music and someone feels so bad about themselves that they've gone and killed themselves. So it was the thing. But what it allowed me to then do is I really thought it was going to destroy me. I thought it was going to kill me. And my mum was always, you know, what doesn't kill you makes you stronger. And there's a reason for this happening. And I remember looking at her and thinking, all these wise words, why doesn't she just frig off, you know? It was just, she kept telling me all these wise things. I just wanted to strangle her because I just wanted to be in a corner on my own. But she would never leave me to go into that space. And so she said, why don't you study? And that's what I did. I studied everything from trying to connect to dead people so that I could see what had happened to him. And of course, I couldn't do that. I went to train as a medium and sort of working in spiritual churches. And I did that. And I did that for a long time. And I became the best, one of the best mediums in the Southeast connecting to spirit. And then I left that very quickly because I found that everybody that goes to the spiritual churches wanted to connect with dead people, and they were stealing messages from one another. And, you know, it just felt really sad. So then I went and studied psychology and psychotherapy, and I then studied that side of it I went back to university to study that side and became a member of the British Association of Counselling and Psychotherapy. And then I studied more, and, you know, I wanted to learn about hypnotherapy, because every time you study something, there's always another piece that you need to learn. So I'd work with clients, and I did counselling, and then I'd work with clients, and then I needed to study about, I'd take them back into, when we did hypnosis or memory recall, they'd go back into the womb. And so then I'd wanted to study past life. So I'd study a little bit about that. And you know, so you're constantly learning. This is the thing about life. If you get on the study bug, oh my Lord, you're studying so much. And then I wanted to study about crystals. So I studied all the energy. And so everything I was actually doing was about, everything that I realized I was doing, Martin, was actually about energy. I studied psychology, I studied the hypnotherapy, I studied all of that. But the thing that really brought it all back home was Dad's thing about energy and tapping within yourself. You know, even when the Twin Towers came down, when the 9/11 happened and the Twin Towers came down, that was a massive impact for us. So much so that the day before then, from 6 o'clock the night before, I was so agitated. I just couldn't settle. My husband was saying, "What is wrong with you?" You know, and I was agitated, and I knew so I kept putting the news on. Something was wrong. I was rang the family. Is everybody okay? What's going on? I took the children to the school that day. You know, and in the end, this is going to sound really odd, okay? Because it's not something I've done, and I have a phobia of needles. I'm terrified of them. In the end, I drove all the way up to a shop. And I asked them to pierce me. The guy said, "Where do you want to be pierced?" I'm just anywhere, my ear, my nose, anything, just pierce something. I just knew I needed to be pierced. And it was only, and then after I did that, they did that, I went home, I put the telly on, and within 5 minutes of walking in the front door, because I felt better after the piercing, within 5 minutes of walking in the front door, I put the telly on, and she said, "It's Kay Burley, this is Sky News, the plane has gone into World Trade Center." And I knew then that's what it was about. You see, what had happened is I needed to pierce the energy because it had got so big, it didn't know what to do with itself. And so that energy needed to be, it needed to release something. That's what the piercing was about. Okay. That's what we do when we tap into people's energy. We tap into their energy as a psychologist, as a psychotherapist, as a counselor. You're tapping into their energy to allow them to release something that's dragging them down. It doesn't have to be as extreme as my physical piercing. But mine was a physical piercing. As a shaman, I needed that physical piercing to allow me to allow that energy to evaporate. Isn't that crazy?
Well, it is and it isn't, because I can relate to it from an artistic point of view. I haven't written a song for a while, but when I do, it feels as though I'm aware that there's a song. I might be aware of a few of the lines. I might be sitting there. I know it's potential. I'm aware that I've already got the riffs going on the bridge, and I know it's going to be enormous, but it's not ready till it's ready, until eventually it has to be released. And there was one song, I sat on it for 10 years. It started off with a riff on a piano, and I sat on it for 10 years. And then the process of doing it bit by bit, I just went to the piano, because I'm not a piano player, I've never been trained to play piano, and bit by bit pieced together this song over a year. Would you say that's the same process, that when it happens through a song, or now for you, through a piece of art, it's the same process that's happening?
Probably when you're going back to the music and the art, yes, it's probably the same thing. When we did the art, one of the things that I felt, I did a piece of art, and there was one piece that was so difficult to do. It was like my 9/11, I called it. In fact, that's what we called it. We called it, it was Ground Zero, because it was so difficult to do. I got Dad's eye out, couldn't get anything else. I was crying and screaming, and I'm a musician. You know, musicians are quite level-headed, so I was like, la, la, la. But all of a sudden, I had this piece of art in front of me. I was cutting my hair and sticking it on this piece of art. There was tears on it. There was blood on it. It was just crazy. And in the end, a client called in. So this is how spirit work. A client called in for a reading. And they're ringing in. And it just so happened to be one of the clients who worked at one of the big galleries, one of the big sort of galleries in London. And she said to me, "Oh, I'm having a reading." And I said, I can't cope right now, not now. And I'd never, ever been in that state with a client. She said, "What's wrong? Tell me what's up. Something's wrong." And I said, "I'm trying to do this piece of art. I can't get enough on the page. I just couldn't get enough of me onto the page." And, you know, she's experienced at this. They're Saatchi, for God's sake. They know all this stuff. And she said, "It's normal. It's normal. Just go with it. Try and finish it. It's normal." And that's actually what I did. And, you know, the funniest thing is, that's the most beautiful piece now. If you look on the website, that's the one that becomes dark light, because it took me a long time. I just couldn't look at it. Every time I looked at it, it would make me cry. It was too painful. And it was just an eye and a face, and it was all scratched up, and it was so much angst on there. But actually what happened, one day I came back to this piece of artwork and I just sat down and I was at peace with it. So any demons that I'd had for my dad at that point had gone. I was really at peace with myself, and it's now so colourful. It's beautiful colours. And actually what it is, it's painted in neon. My daughter had bought me some of these little pots of neon paint, which I'd used. This was the first one I'd used it for. But it's actually painted in neon. So what you do is you put a black light on, and it shines like a beacon. So it, for me, it's like a message from heaven sort of saying, I'm okay, we're okay, we're good, you know. And that was a struggle. That was a struggle from an artistic perspective, because I would never have known that. You know, when I work with music, I don't struggle in that way at all. I can sit down and write something. When we did this artwork, Martin, I suddenly felt like I needed to put music to the art, and that's what I did. So there's an album out called April Love, which is all about the music for the art. So you look at the art while you're listening to this music, and it was fabulous. It was a fabulous way. But yeah, I've had that angst just that once where I thought I think it must have been how some of these artists feel when they cut off their ear and they do all these crazy things, because they just don't know how to do enough. You just don't know how to do enough. And I've never had that in music. It was a completely different energy this time.
Well, I can honestly say I've never heard an artist describe so well and so vividly, if you like, the pain of giving birth to art. So thank you for that. Next track, which I'm not going to go into details with this, because it brings a lot of pain for you, for what it links back to. But we're going to play If Paradise Is Half As Nice by Armin Corner. We're now going to move in a completely different direction, in a way. I was talking to you earlier on about the fact that, you know, we get more happiness and a feeling of richness in life when we do the things that make us happy. So even if we're doing a job that we can't stand, if you've got a guitar, pick it up, strum it, go and play a note on your piano. And that brought me to another aspect of you, if you like, and what you do. I know you've written a children's book that touches on this theme of different musical instruments having different personalities, if you like. And I was saying to you, for me, you know, the cello, I can't play cello and how to make sounds out of it. It feels like it's massaging my whole being. And I know that you're a fan of cello, and I know that the cello's got quite a key role in your book, which is called Hummingland, I believe.
So Hummingland is, we won the Sylvia Anderson Award for that last December, so I'm the Children's Author of the Year for this at the moment, which is a really special treat. But the book is about the naughty cello. The cello represents humanity and how we're all naughty little instruments trying to do the best that we can do. He's not really naughty, he's not naughty at all. What he's doing is he's testing boundaries. If you think of him as like an 8-year-old, testing boundaries to see what he can do with his life and see whether something fits for him. But I started Hummingland because, as I say, my dad gave me a drum, and the drum in Hummingland is Drumi, my drum. And that's where Hummingland came from. It came from the story of my little drum that I would use. And I took my drum everywhere with me. When I was a child, back in the day of the dinosaurs, there was no backpacks and all that malarkey. And so my mum would put him in a pillowcase and give them to me, and I would carry him everywhere with me. You know, so that's probably why everybody hated me. But so I was quite freakish in the sense that I would go everywhere and I'd carry my drum and I'd show people how to steal their heartbeats and all this malarkey. But that's where Hummingland came from. Hummingland came from Drumi the drum, and how it takes all sorts of instruments, all sorts of colours, all sorts of melodies, all sorts of tunes, and it takes tolerance of all those differences to make a happy orchestra. And to me, I look at it as we are the orchestra of life. You know, we're all the different nationalities, we're different colours, we're different shapes, we're different sizes, humanity. But we have to get together and we have to be accepting of one another. And so I thought, what was the best way to teach them that? Because obviously, I have my own youth foundation, which is for 11 to 21, 22-year-olds, for some of them who have special needs or whatever.
What's that called?
Teo Youth Foundation, Teo Evan Hendricks Youth Foundation. But with this, the spirit came and they said, you need to go younger. We need to start them really young, because by the time they get to 11, 12, 13, much of the damage, if you like, is already done. They've been instilled with the fears of their parents, their clergy, their teachers, their this, their that. All the fear that's coming from people, those people that are telling you you'll never amount to anything, is coming from a place of fear. So what we wanted to do with Hummingland was start in a storybook where the children could just read it, and hopefully parents would read it too, Martin, and start to think, oh yeah, I could be different. You know, because it's actually talking about, from a psychology perspective, it's talking about tolerance and intolerance and abuse, and how, you know, it's good to accept differences. And it's talking about time and the power of time and the strength of time, and why time is so important to keep your word to children and or to one another. There's a lot of life lessons in there, and that's what's so good about it.
Okay. What I'm going to do is listen to your next track, which is Dancing Queen. While I don't claim to be a muso, even I know that that's ABBA. So whatever you're doing now, unless you're driving a taxi at home,
have a little wiggle.
Have a little wiggle to this. This is Dancing Queen by ABBA.
Anybody could be that guy. The night is young and the music's
as I've said to you, there's so many different aspects of who you are and what you do. But in my mind, this is certainly the feeling I get. It's all connected with this idea of you being the most authentic you that you can be and not having any barriers to that, and also enabling other people to discover or rediscover who they really are and to express it in a spirit of love. And that's come through very clearly, I think, in lots of the things that we've discussed. So I know that you've recently got a Peace Award in Belfast, I believe, in Northern
yes.
Ireland. Do you want to tell us about that and the work that led to that?
It was awarded from World Equal. And World Equal Peace Award for 2019. It's the first award that they're given out. And it's an award, it's an acknowledgement of respect for someone's contribution to bringing peace into the world and into people's lives around the world. So it came about because we are very, you know, they're very aware of the work that we do. We go around and we work with people. Healing from the healing center, from the chair healing center, and from the wellness clinic. We're just opening up a clinic in Harley Street as well. So we work at Harley Street, we work in the Kent healing center, we have our own youth foundation, so we're helping with young children to feel better. Some of our kids are studying, going on to study to be doctors and lawyers and things, which is amazing because they've come out of gangs. Tay Youth is about replacing the knife with knowledge. And sometimes it's very difficult for these kids in schools. You know, they're black kids in schools and they struggle with their teachers. And, you know, they go in and they say, you know, my teacher doesn't think I'm going to achieve too very much. That's the problem that I have with these teachers and the clergy and all of this sort of thing. They put their fears on our children, you know. And so some of the kids come out, Martin, and they're, you know, my teacher doesn't think I'm going to achieve very much. I've been called to schools before now where the school doesn't call the children's parent, they'll call our youth foundation, say, Cherry, can you come in? And I've had to go in and talk somebody off the ledge where they really wanted to smack one of the teachers. You know, and the thing that I say is, if you really, really want to get a qualification, there is going to be nothing worse than them having to come to a black man like you when they're in trouble and ask for assistance with a legal assistance or a doctor. I said, if you really want to upset people, get a qualification. You don't upset them by leaving school. You upset them by qualifying and having them need you at some point further down the line. And that's what we do. And some of our other clients, we're very blessed. We have some amazing clients who help us, because some of the clients fund some of the youth foundation stuff. You know, and these are just clients on the street like you and I who have their own jobs, but they want to help with a little bit. But they support it because they know there's a need, you know. And if we're going to do something about knife crime or anything like that, the way we're going to do it is to get these children off the streets, out of gangs, and back into school. It really is about replacing the knife with knowledge. That's the only way we're going to do it. I think Equal see that in a lot of the work that we do. I think they see it because we're about to start the next campaign with even younger children. And I think that's it. I don't know why they gave it to me. I suppose it's one of those reasons, but it's an award. It doesn't really make any difference. It doesn't change what I do. It's lovely to have it, but it doesn't change what I do, and it won't do.
I think it's a fantastic reason, and as you say, really, it's more of an affirmation of who you are and what yes. you're doing. And, you know, it resonates with myself, because my 11-year-old is mixed race. Mm-hmm. I'm very aware of what the statistics say about things mm-hmm. like gangs and knives and things like that. We live mm-hmm. in quite a quiet area, an old mining town, and I'd say we've got to worry more about, I used to worry more about racism than knives in that area. But right. Something that you said that really resonated, and I was stunned, I was really shocked, when my son, who's still at an age where he talks about having a massive mansion in LA and how he's going to buy me a Bentley and he'll have me living in a massive house next to him and all these things. Now, I'm not particularly materialistic, and I would always say to him, there's more to life than what you've got. But I'm not going to say to him, you can't get those things. Exactly. I would say, if you want to get those things, you're not going to get them from doing a 9-to-5. And you're not going to become a pop icon without doing all the work and having the right fortune. But I was stunned when I found out that one of his teachers had turned around to him, a group of them in class, and said, you're not going to be rich. I was stunned. And I said to him, how did that make you feel? And you know what he said? You know he said, Teo, which was beautiful.
Made me more determined.
Better than that. He said, I just thought, why are you talking this rubbish? Yes, I am. And I thought, beautiful.
Good.
But as you pointed out, though, you know, not everyone's going to have that spark in front of them. Some children will hear the negativity, and our job, I guess, is to make them hear the voice of hope and what they're capable of.
And just to see who they are. These kids are phenomenal. Who on earth are you to tell them that they're not? Seriously, dude, you're teaching in a school probably because you failed at something else, and you have got the chip on your shoulder to tell my child that. That sets me off. That sets me off. So, you know, some teachers are amazing and we couldn't get better, you know, but oh my gosh, they've got this yin and yang and everything, you know, there's two ends of the spectrum. You've got some who are really bitter, and if your child gets that person, whoa, you know, we got a lot of catching up to do with them. So I think it's important that children recognize how amazing and how awesome they are, and as parents it's our job to remind them. It's not our job to keep coming home going, hey, life is so hard, oh, I've got to spend all my money on this, oh, shut up and get on with it. You know, stop teaching your children that life is hard just because you've chosen a pathway that's actually made it difficult for you or whatever. Doesn't mean you have to share the negatives with the kids. They're children, let them be children.
Fantastic, Teo. Absolutely wonderful. We're coming to the end, almost. We're going to play another track, and then we're going to come back and talk about, you know, how your life is going to, and your work is going to unfold from here, as well as how people can get hold of you. This next track, which is one of yours, Teo, really does tie in what you've been saying. We shall overcome today.
The world is on her knees, and she is calling to each and every one of us to help her to rise in strength and in love. We are champions of every action we take. So love, love yourself, love each other, and let us rise as one. We are one, one love.
We shall overcome, we shall overcome, we shall overcome today. We shall overcome today. We'll walk hand in hand. We'll walk hand in hand. We are not afraid today.
Today. love each other and let us love as one.
We are one. One love.
So, Teo, thanks again for giving me so much time today. It is a pre-recorded show, but we've had the most magnificent conversations in between takes, if you like. And I think we've really discovered an overall theme that we're going to finish on. But before we delve...
Okay. Our goal is really just to help people to sort of get on to the next pathway. And actually, this is perfect timing. Our books are generally closed, but they're actually opening from the 1st of November throughout November. So anybody that we take on as new clients during that time can stay on the books. But our books are generally closed. But because of all the artwork that we're doing, we have a little bit of time. So we're free now. So if you want to contact us, feel free to do that. It'd be great to hear from them.
Okay, now I'm going to bring in the last segment, if you like, of what we've been talking quite delicately, because it'd be the first time I've really spoke about it from my perspective ever on air.
I've always been,
and you know what I'm going to say, of course. I've always been a very perceptive person. I've got quite an ability for recognising faces. I'm very sensitive to patterns, which has come through in things like music, how I play chess. And it's the reason why I edit books. I just see that that's not the right order. There's something missing. I intuit the bits that the author's missed out, the blind spots, But recently, a number of things have been happening. And actually, I've shared some of it, but I haven't said the conclusion. A number of things have been happening to me that were more than just synchronicity, more than just coincidence, that made me think, no, I'm connecting to something bigger, what some people might call clairvoyant or psychic or connecting to universal consciousness. And I've been talking about this with you, and it's resonated with you. And it seems that there's a kind of reason why you and I may be talking, because I'll let you explain it, but you were talking to me about your own connection with work, with consciousness.
I mean, in terms of where we are, my connection, I'm a shaman, so you understand what a shaman is when we work with, okay. So I'm a shaman, I'm a medium, I'm a... energy consultant, energy specialist, as I say, when the Twin Towers came down, they actually contacted us to clear the site for the Native Americans with the energy of the site. So we work with a lot of energy. It's about, a lot of people will contact us when they have, you know, juju on them and bad things happen. They contact us to sort of get those things removed, because it's all about connecting with your inner self, and it's all about recognizing when there's an imbalance somewhere. And what I do is I recognize the imbalance. I can tap into you in the same way with you. I can tap into somebody and see what's wrong fairly quickly. You know, I also work with King's College oncology department in London, but that's because that's a cancer side there. But, and we work with them because we're able to see quite quickly where there's a problem with something. It's all about energy, all about energy. When you look at everything in your life has an energy, Martin. You know, the table that you're sat at, the microphone that you're using, the car, everything has an energy. You know, if anybody's ever seen The Matrix, it is very similar to that. Everything has its own energy. It's just literally a case of how it's perceived by other people. And we already know all of this stuff because we're already, you know, spiritual beings. It's just a case of when we recall it and how quickly we recall it. If you visualize it like when you're at school, when you pick your secondary school or when you pick a school for your child to go to, you go and you study and you say, does it have art? Does it have badminton? Does it have this? Does it have that? Does it have the science they want to study? When you're picking to come here from spirit, that's exactly what you're choosing. You know, you might get three or four different bodies or lives that you could choose into. And actually what you're doing is you're saying, what does my next lesson want to be? Does it want to be love? Does it want to be gratitude? What does it want to be? And so you will go into those lives that will teach you, give you the opportunity to have those experiences, you know? And if something happens in your life where, for instance, say your mother will die young or this person happens or that, that's probably part of the journey, you know? And it's just like school. If something doesn't go right, you know, if you arrive for your art lesson or your maths class and the teacher doesn't show up, you're not left there all the lesson to get on with it. They send a substitute in. Exactly the same in life. If you're supposed to meet somebody and something happens and they don't follow their path or they don't quite get to you, the universe will send a substitute in. So you will still get to learn a version of that lesson. You know, so we are all constantly learning lessons. We are all here purely to learn how to have a human experience in this spiritual being that we are. And actually, every time we do something, that's helping us to learn. But I want to end with this one thing. Everything you ever need to know is already within you. It's just a case of recalling it and tapping into it. The most important thing that you should do is to remember there is a child within each of us. I call it the inner child. And that child is the child that gets up every day and goes to face things, whether they're fearful or not. They still get up on those brave little legs and off they go to face the dilemma of the day. So that's the person you've got to tap into and take care of and connect to and make sure that you're doing the best that you can do. And when you're fearful, that's probably because he or she is fearful, but she's still got up and gone out and done it anyway. So you tap into that inner child no matter what happens and take care of that child as if it's your most precious jewel, because you know what? It is. And that's what we've got to be clear in our own mind with. We have to take care of ourselves first. So it doesn't matter what everybody else is saying, whether they think you're right, you're wrong, if something you've done today has helped them or hasn't helped them, whether you suffer from mental health issues or, you know, whether you're whatever is going on within you, you are doing the best that you can do. You have to tap into your inner child, and when you need help, you reach out to somebody and you ask for it. But find somebody who you know will support you, not judge you.
Absolutely beautiful words there, Teo. Thank you very much for this interview.
You're welcome.
It's been a pleasure talking to you, and I hope we have many more conversations to come. For you at home.
It's been lovely to speak to you as well. It's been amazing, Martin. Thank you so much for sharing your stories on and off air as well.
Thank you, Teo. And thank you at home or wherever you are around the world for listening to this week's Culture Pot. You've been listening to Martin Morrison interviewing Teo Irvine. I've got it right this time. Hendrix. So whatever you're doing, take care of yourselves, take care of each other, and I'll be back next week. Bye-bye.
Have a great Sunday.
Thank you, Teo. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.